The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, this panel, which we will now begin, deals with relationship between human rights and humanitarian law and its impact on the promotion of international criminal justice. I'm the moderator of the panel, but I just wanted to say one thing. Because Arye mentioned the conversation that we had yesterday when he came in for another meeting. And when one thinks back that it was almost 20 years ago that we had the beginning of the fight against impunity, for accountability, and for justice. And these were very courageous people, such as Emilio Mignone in Argentina, others from Uruguay, who filed the first suits ever before an intergovernmental body seeking to challenge the amnesty laws in Argentina and in Uruguay. I had the good fortune of being one of the attorneys involved in that suit, in those suits. And after 5 years of litigation, which was not easy, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in 1992 declared those amnesty laws to be inconsistent, inviolative of the state party's obligations, and ordered the states to take appropriate measures to investigate and identify and to sanction the perpetrators, as well as to pay an adequate reparation to the victims. The commission continued to consolidate its jurisprudence, and one of the things which I think needs to be noted and how things have changed. Not too long ago, the Supreme Court of Argentina, based on the jurisprudence of the Inter-American Commission and Court, nullified the effects of its previous decision, upholding the constitutionality of the amnesty laws, which will lead now to investigation and prosecution of many state agents who committed crimes against humanity. There are many implications of the work of human rights bodies and so forth and what they do in establishing state responsibility and so forth in relation to the important work that international tribunals do in really upholding human dignity through seeking accountability through the prosecution of individuals who commit war crimes and crimes against humanity. So I just wanted to mention this to you. Our first speaker will be Judge Pat Wald, who has had a distinguished career in this country, both in government as well as in the judicial branch, and served for a period of several years as a judge on the ICTY. We're going to ask each of the panelists to speak for 12 minutes so that we'll be able to have a period of questions from the floor. Pat?
Get up here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bob. I'm going to discuss a somewhat specialized facet of the general topic of the relationship between international humanitarian law and human rights. I'm going to talk about this relationship in the context of two fledgling war crimes courts that have been created within the national judicial systems of two countries, Iraq and Cambodia, which have not been noted for their adherence to human rights norms in the immediate past. I think these experiences in Iraq and Cambodia are important because, as Arye Nair and Diane have said, the future implementation of international humanitarian law, at least so far as judicial enforcement is concerned, probably lies in great part in the national or the hybrid or perhaps the regional courts created at or near the scene of the conflicts and inevitably embedded, as Diane suggested, in the cultural and political backdrop of the country where the crimes were committed. In Iraq and Cambodia, unlike even Sierra Leone, which will be discussed at much greater length later on, in Iraq and Cambodia, the majority, or in Iraq's case, the totality of the judges, as well as most of the prosecutors and staff, are going to be indigenous to the country. And the law applied, except for the definitions of the universal crimes and some ancillary provisions taken from international humanitarian law, are predominantly going to be the law of the country not international law. Now, I think two critical issues arise from this scenario. First, can these national courts really function independently and efficiently in their native habitats? And second, will their presence require or precipitate the recognition and enforcement of significant human rights norms formally rejected or ignored in the regular court systems of those countries? It's an early point at which to make any confident assessment, but not too early, I think, to suggest some significant signals that are worth watching. First, Iraq. The Iraqi Special Tribunal, or IST, was established at the end of 2003, first in a law passed by the Provisional Authority, but later repassed by the Iraqi interim government, and recently made a national law by the Iraqi Parliament. It was reportedly in its original form drafted by Iraqi expatriates with the help of Americans, but in large part it copied the charters. If you read it very largely, it copied the charters of the ad hoc tribunals and the International Criminal Court, with some crucial exceptions that I'll talk about. But the international community wanted a much more internationalized court, either an ad hoc tribunal like the ICTY or the ICTR, or at least one with significant participation by international judges and personnel like Sierra Leone. Instead, the IST, the Iraqi court, provides for Iraqi judges only. There is a provision, at least in the English version. There's always a problem in the English version and the Iraq version. But so far as we can tell, there is a provision that non-Iraqi judges could be appointed if deemed necessary, but that hasn't happened, and my surmise is it probably won't before the trials get going. The IST has jurisdiction only over Iraqi nationals who've committed genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, along with several national crimes. These crimes had to have been committed between 1968 and the end of the Iraqi invasion in May 2003. It's to follow Iraqi criminal procedure law, except as set out in the IST law itself or in the revised rules for the tribunal. Now, importantly, I think it's fair to say that the majority of international humanitarian law concepts adopted in the ad hoc court charters and in the ICC are present in that IST law, and the rules, at least in the English version. Here I note that many of these provisions in the rules and in the charter itself are human rights norms as well as international humanitarian law principles, though I admittedly make no pretense of being able to draw clear distinctions at all times, what's a human rights principle and what's an international humanitarian law principle. I know it when I see it, but that's about it. Thus, we see in the IST law and the rules provisions, there will be no immunity granted for official positions, though there were such immunities under the Iraq penal law. The Nuremberg obedience order defense is rejected. Command responsibility is accepted. Article 20 of the Iraqi law sets out the usual rights of the accused found in all the war crime tribunal charters: public trial, presumption of innocence, notice of charges, counsel assigned, prompt trial, ability to mount a defense and to obtain witnesses, to confront evidence, not to be compelled to testify against oneself. The court's also required to write a reasoned opinion for its decisions, and there is a right to appeal sentence or conviction to an appeals chamber. The rules stress the independence of the judges, who are to take no instruction from other parts of the government or anyone else, as well as their duty to refrain from deciding cases in which they have a financial or personal interest. Nonetheless, human rights groups have opposed the tribunal on several bases. Some are grounded in human rights doctrines, but some would appear, at least to me, to be more pragmatic concerns that Iraqi judges may just not be up to the job of deciding complex, prolonged cases involving IHL doctrines to which they've only recently been exposed in crash training courses. But the deal breaker for most of these groups, I think, is the allowance of the death penalty, something which, incidentally, I'm told, and I have reason to believe it, the American advisors didn't want. Paul Bremer actually suspended it while he was in charge of the provisional government, but the Iraqis demanded it. This inclusion of the death penalty has brought down the condemnation of the United Nations as well as the European Union members and a myriad, understandably, of international NGOs. The death penalty may or may not be an absolute human rights canon, but for these purposes it appears to be treated as such. Thus, the UN, most EU countries except to some degree the UK, and most of the important international NGOs have refused to provide any assistance at all to the tribunal, the UN going so far as to forbid its personnel serving in other tribunals from giving advice or training to the Iraqi judges. The ICC happily has not so enjoined its people. This boycott, I feel, has some ironic effects insofar as any goal of international humanitarian law bringing in its wake human rights advances in previously hostile countries. For the IST law requires that in each branch of the tribunal, investigative, trial, and appeal, as well as in the offices of the prosecutor and defense, that there have to be appointed non-Iraqi advisors and observers to, quote, from the law, provide nonpartisan expert advice and recommendations, particularly in the area of international norms. Thus far, we have no such advisors except for the Americans serving on site. None have agreed to serve. Now, one has got to wonder if this to-the-wall approach, cutting off a potential source of international law advice, ends up being counterproductive to the introduction of human rights law into the court. More? Wow. Okay, I got to jump a lot here. I think this has human rights consequences, for in fact, it is the jurisprudence of the ad hoc tribunals that has, in effect, joined international humanitarian law and human rights at the hip. Because rarely is there an international court decision that interprets IHL in a way that doesn't encompass relevant human rights law as well. For instance, the wholesale adoption of the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights guarantees to accused as practiced in the ad hoc tribunals. That's a prime example. And the IST law and rules calls for consideration of international law both in the rules of detention and in the rules of penalty. So I think I've made my point there. I'm going to skip very quickly over to my summary conclusions on Iraqi war crimes trials, and then I'll take 1 minute on Cambodia. The basic law and rules, I think, in Iraq, with a few exceptions, follow international humanitarian law tenets closely. And I think a significant opportunity for international input into human rights as well as IH law is being lost because of the dispute principally over the death penalty. IHL and human rights law have been melded in other war crimes tribunals, and that meld could constructively be brought into Iraqi law and practice. Dozens of these IST judges will rejoin a pool of regular judges when the tribunal is over, and they could impact criminal procedures throughout that country's law in their experience. I have 1 minute on Cambodia.
Sure.
Okay.
I'm not in a position to say no.
Take a big.
You are. After many years of frustrating on-again, off-again negotiating with the UN, Cambodia did arrive an agreed format for a tribunal to try the surviving leaders of the Khmer Rouge regime from 75 to 79 that oversaw the starvation, torture, execution, and mass displacement of up to 3 million Cambodian citizens. The Cambodian parliament subsequently passed a law creating this extraordinary chambers to prosecute and try the most senior and most responsible perpetrators of those atrocities. The KRT, as it's known, will be a national court employing Cambodian law, except where inconsistent with international law or where there's a lacuna in national law. It'll have a majority of Cambodian judges, but a minority of judges picked from a list of UN nominees. Like Iraq, it will use a civil law mode of trial, and there will be international and Cambodian co-prosecutors and co-investigative judges. No judicial decision, interestingly enough, can be made without the consent of at least one international judge. Cambodia has no death penalty, so the tribunal will impose only maximum life sentences, but minimum 5-year sentences. Now, the Cambodian law has all the required ingredients for UN approval. Judges have to be independent. They must have experience in criminal law or international law. Accused get all the ICC, International Compact, Civil and Political Rights rights. The interesting thing about Cambodia is that Cambodia is what I call a joiner. It's been a party to the ICC, it's a party to the Torture Convention, it's a party to the ICCPR, it's even a party to CEDAW, the Anti-Discrimination Against Women. It excludes evidence if it's gathered illegally. It does basically, in the law, anything that our ad hoc tribunals would want it to do. But that said, and here I think the problem is different from Iraq, human rights advocates, both inside and outside of Cambodia, have some cause to worry about the capacity of the tribunal to provide fair trials, because it's no secret that the reputation of the regular courts for impartial justice and independence from the executive branch has been tarnished very recently by some cases which have taken judges who were troublesome and reassigned them and made more compliant ones come in their place. Human Rights Watch concluded in a year or so ago, the judicial system remains extremely weak and generally unable to deliver justice to those whose human rights are violated. Security officials have been accused of torturing detainees. Prison conditions are lousy. The media is subject to intimidation on occasion. Elections are sometimes manipulated, accompanied by political violence. My final point, and it is final, the operation of a legitimate war crimes court as part of a judiciary with fundamental problems is going to take considerable effort. If the provisions of this law, the KRT law, are scrupulously honored, it can happen. But again, that is going to highlight the endemic chasm between internationalized and purely domestic courts in deficient systems. Cultural change doesn't come easily, especially if there's no will for it at the top levels of government. What it will take to demonstrate the will in Cambodia cases is first the appointment of Cambodia judges, they've not yet been appointed, who refuse to indulge in either bribes or governmental instruction. Nobody is willing to guess how big that pool is. But the announcement that the judges will receive $65,000 a year, an astronomical sum in Cambodia, may act as somewhat of a buffer in that regard. But the international presence in the Cambodia tribunal in the form of tiebreaker judges nominated by the UN is absolutely critical. These judges, who haven't been yet announced either, must not only be competent but aggressively watchful and willing to speak up when any signs of government or other outside control appear. In the end, Cambodia does, however, present a unique challenge to the advance of international humanitarian law in countries with deficient judicial systems. There cannot and will not be an international court or ICC availability, as we've heard again and again, for every post-conflict or transitional government. And when countries like Cambodia finally get to the point of agreeing to an acceptable law governing trial of these universal crimes, how should the international community react? Help them until it's clear that they're not acting in good faith, or insist on basic and realistically unlikely reforms in general human rights conditions before such a court will be assisted? It's also noteworthy that the kind of problems confronted in Cambodia are in effect a preview of what the ICC may frequently face in its own complementarity decisions about whether a state is able or willing to do its own dirty work in trying international crimes, and at what critical juncture the international community will help or abandon them. Thank you for your indulgence on the extra week.
Thank you, Pat. Our next speaker is Valerie Osterveld, who's a professor of law at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. Okay.
Thank you very much. I'm not going to talk about Cambodia and Iraq today, but I will talk about the other tribunals, and I'd like to focus on the issue of gender-based violence. I'd like to think of it as a sort of a puzzle. Let's go back to 1993, when the International Criminal Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia, or ICTY, was founded, and take a look at what they had to deal with when examining issues of gender-based violence. They didn't have a whole lot. International humanitarian law was relatively narrow in terms of addressing gender-based violence that comes in the wake or as part of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. international human rights law was slightly better, but not very well developed at that time. And international criminal law, if I could be nice about it, was abysmal on gender-based violence at the time. Now, in 2005, what do we have? We have tribunals that have pieced together, bit by bit, a puzzle that's not complete, but which is far more comprehensive than it was in 1993. And we have a better picture, a much more clear picture on how to address these kinds of crimes in international courts and tribunals. Let's start with international human rights law. The ICTY was founded in 1993, and that was also the same year as the UN World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna. And for those of you who were there, you'll remember the rallying cry, "Women's rights are human rights." At the same time, there was discussion, because so many women had come from the former Yugoslavia to Vienna, about getting the issue of gender violence in armed conflict on the agenda. And the outcome document, the Vienna Declaration and Program of Action, did address this, albeit in a very general way. It specifically recognized that women are vulnerable to sexual violence during armed conflict and condemned sexual violence as a human rights violation, specifically requiring a particularly effective response. Now, I know that that is diplomatic language. I used to be a diplomat, and I know what that means. But it was a huge step forward at the time. Prior to that, there had been very little recognition in the human rights world of gender-based violence in international human rights. And really, a lot of that attention had only come the year before, in 1992, when the issue of comfort women had come on the agenda of the UN. So that was a step forward. In 1995, we had the UN World Conference on Women. And the resulting document, the Beijing Platform for Action, had an entire subject area devoted to women in armed conflict. That was light years forward from even 1993. It set out a more sort of comprehensive approach to women in armed conflict and recognized not only rape, which was a word that had been used in the human rights parlance at the time to actually mean something much larger, but it also talked about sexual slavery, enforced prostitution, forced pregnancy, sexual abuse, gender-based persecution, and new forms of gender-focused violence that hadn't been thought of before in the human rights community. There was also recognition that crimes are interlinked. I mean, it only makes sense, right? But it hadn't been thought of before. Rape can be used to torture somebody. Sexual mutilation can be used as a form of extermination. These kinds of things got the human rights community thinking about the picture of gender-based violence in human rights. You can see that in only 2 years, the discussion had come far. But since that time, since 1995 to 2005, there's been a decade. And it's been really exciting to see that in international human rights law, the understanding of the place of gender-based violence during genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity has expanded several-fold. The understanding has extended to thinking about what is the role of gender-based violence prior to the descent into conflict or massive breakdown of a society. What is the role, of course, during that conflict or during the genocide or crimes against humanity? And what is the role afterwards? How does gender-based violence during conflict end up being correlated to domestic violence in the country that's rebuilding? So this much larger picture is where we're at today in human rights law. I want to note, though, one challenge that remains in this area. Human rights law tends to focus or equate the word gender with women. And we have to remember that during genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, gender-based violence can happen against men. And often this violence against men is interrelated with the kind of violence that happens against women, and we need to keep this larger picture in mind. If we can go back now to 1993 and think of humanitarian law, it hasn't actually changed in text between 1993 and 2005. But back in 1993, the ICTY had to only look at the Geneva Conventions and the additional protocols which listed enforced prostitution and rape in their provisions. But international humanitarian law did, in fact, have a longer history of dealing with gender-based violence than did international human rights law. And interestingly, the additional protocols have gender-neutral provisions which recognize that men can be raped too, for example, or men can suffer kinds of sexual violence as well. And this was ahead of the times, ahead of international human rights law at that time. International criminal law in 1993. I'm afraid it was the most undeveloped area of the law with respect to gender-based violence, and in fact had the narrowest conception of that kind of violence in genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Now, why do I say that? Of course, international human rights law and international humanitarian law are now considered as falling, for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity are considered as falling within international criminal law. But back then, the only experience that we had was the International Military Tribunals of World War II, and our colleague here, Kelly Askin, did one of the groundbreaking studies which showed that despite evidence being put forward of gender-based violence at those military tribunals, really that evidence was ignored, and the issue was basically ignored. Fast forward to 2005, what do we have here? We have really night and day. We have judges like Judge Wald here on our panel who helped to develop that picture, to help explain where gender-based violence and it fits within international criminal law, but also how do we get at it in international criminal law. The ICTY and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the ICTR, began the process of trailblazing. First of all, through the Office of the Prosecutor, by issuing indictments, some of which had very sophisticated readings of how to look at gender-based violence. It was through those indictments that the issues of rape and torture were linked, for example. The evidence that was brought forward in those tribunals had an effect on international criminal law. It's kind of hard to imagine, but back in 1997, 1998, when we were drafting the gender provisions in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, we didn't have a whole lot to go on except for the statutes of the ICTY and ICTR and the Geneva Conventions and additional protocols. What did we look at? We looked at the evidence that had been brought forward. We had no case law yet from the international criminal tribunals, but we looked at the evidence. That evidence showed that gender-based violence can happen in a whole host of ways that hadn't been recognized so far. That's why the Rome Statute looks the way it does in the gender-based provisions, with recognition of sexual slavery, for example, included in there, and gender-based persecution. It's because of the evidence that was brought forward in those tribunals. Perhaps most importantly for the long-lasting effect in international criminal law, the international criminal tribunals actually sat down and separated out the elements of crime for crimes such as rape. And in cases like Akayesu, Musema, Frunzia, for example, and enslavement as a crime against humanity. Now, turning to the ICC. The ICC, of course, is in a more nascent stage and has a lot more to do in terms of if it's investigations, getting people in the courtroom before we can actually take a look at the case law that the ICC will be creating. But the statute itself has put forward international criminal law. Included in it is gender-based persecution. For the first time in international criminal law, taken in from international refugee law. Some other things taken in from international human rights law are human trafficking, included as an example of enslavement. And unfortunately, I must say, even though I was involved in the negotiation of this, international human rights law did bring in something not as good, which is a bizarre-looking definition of gender, and that's linked to the ongoing debate in the human rights world between very conservative countries and other countries about what does gender mean. But I must say that that definition is not as backward-looking as it looks. It's actually quite progressive, and it has to be read as such by the ICC's judges. The Sierra Leone Special Court. We have here former prosecutor David Crane. He did something that is really exciting in international criminal law, and of which I think the prosecutor for the ICC, Ocampo, will be thinking about as he proceeds, and that is to see how international human rights law, international humanitarian law, can be combined together to come up with something where different elements, different acts can actually result in something more. So in David Crane's case, he took the Revolutionary United Front and Armed Forces Revolutionary Council indictments and listed the crime of forced marriage. That's not in the statute of the Sierra Leone Tribunal, but he found it there inherently. Because if you combine together, if you consolidate the crimes against humanity of rape, sexual slavery, and other inhumane acts, and the war crime of outrages on personal dignity, you can get something larger, something that is called forced marriage. And I'm sure that there are more such consolidated outcomes out there. So where are we today? We started off with relatively narrow conceptions of gender-based violence in international humanitarian law, almost nothing in international criminal law, something a little bit wider in international human rights law. Today, we have all together, as a whole, all of that fits together to bring us a much more detailed case law. Now, I'm not saying that we're done, though. We have far, 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 far more to go. I won't outline all the different ways, but I just need to warn that we shouldn't remain static. The problem before 1993 is that these issues remained relatively static in international humanitarian law, relatively unexplored, same in international human rights law. And it's only because of progressive understandings in the international criminal tribunals that we are where we are today with gender-based violence. And we have to make sure that we can't fall back into this relative acceptance of the status quo when it relates to gender-based violence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Valerie. Our next speaker will be Douglas Cassell, who is the Lilly Endowment Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Civil and Human Rights at Notre Dame Law School.
First of all, congratulations to Diane, to Bob, to Susanna, and to everyone else who's been involved with the War Crimes Office here at American University. When I received the invitation, there was no doubt, no matter what else was on my agenda, I was going to come, because pound for pound, American University has done more to fight for human rights and international humanitarian law than any other academic institution in the world. And so this is a very appropriate place for this gathering of distinguished people to come together. I'm going to try to take an academic step back, if you will, and talk about the interrelationships between three bodies of law: international human rights law, international humanitarian law, and international criminal law. But before I do that, because this conference is taking place in the United States of America, I think it's important to emphasize that there are no balls that drop between those three outfielders. There is no gap in the protection of basic fundamental rights for all human beings everywhere at all times under international law. It doesn't matter whether you are a so-called unlawful enemy combatant or unprivileged belligerent. It doesn't matter whether you are in Guantanamo or some ghost prison in Pakistan. It doesn't matter whether you are acting in peace or war. All of us, because we are human beings, have basic fundamental human rights, and international law recognizes and protects those rights at all times and all places. Now, the relationship between the three bodies of law, and I'll shorthand them to human rights, criminal, and humanitarian, is complementary, it is mutually reinforcing, and there is a multifaceted interrelationship. I don't have time today to go into exhaustive analysis of that, but simply by way of illustration, I will talk first about human rights law, second about the interactions between human rights and humanitarian law, third about the interactions between criminal and humanitarian law, and fourth between criminal and human rights law. First of all, human rights law. The basic human rights treaties apply in peacetime as well as wartime, contrary to the positions asserted before the United Nations and the International Court of Justice by the United States and Israel. Human rights treaties are not limited to peacetime. They apply in war as well. And they apply, of course, to protect all persons, whether innocent or guilty, whether lawful political dissidents or alleged terrorists, whether citizens of a country or foreign nationals. There are, of course, a few basic rights which may be reserved to citizens, such as the right to vote. But the basic rights of the human person, of personal integrity, to be free from torture, from ill treatment, from extrajudicial execution, forced disappearance, arbitrary or prolonged detention, and violations of the basic rights of fair trial, extend to all human beings. Now, just as citizenship is not a basis to deny these rights, nor is the place where the human beings are found. It does not matter whether the victim of a violation is located within the sovereign territory of the state violating the rights. What matters, according to the jurisprudence of the Human Rights Committee of the United Nations and other human rights bodies, largely reinforced by the recent jurisprudence of the ICJ, is whether the victim is within the power or effective control of the violating state. And of course, that power and effective control in many instances is exercised outside the sovereign territory, especially by a military power like the United States. Human rights apply, as I mentioned earlier, also in times of war and in military occupations, not only in times of peace. In some treaties, this is quite explicit. The Torture Convention expressly provides that the prohibition against torture cannot be justified by any consideration of war. The American Convention on Human Rights expressly provides in its derogation provision that certain rights may, within certain very tightly confined limits, be derogated from in time of war. So obviously the non-derogable rights continue to apply in time of war. In other treaties, this is implicit. The Civil and Political Covenant Derogation Clause does not refer to war as a basis for derogation, but rather refers to national emergencies. But nonetheless, the Civil and Political Covenant has been interpreted quite properly by both the UN bodies and the ICJ, such that the ICPR protections continue to apply in wartime. Now, of course, once we get to wartime, that brings me to the second topic, which is the interrelation between human rights and humanitarian law. In the recent advisory opinion on the Israeli barrier being built in Palestine, the ICJ pointed out that there are three possible situations of relationship between human rights and humanitarian law during a war period. One is where the international humanitarian law norm applies and there is no corresponding human rights norm to overlap with it. So, for example, under the Hague regulations, there is a requirement for the occupying power to preserve the laws in force prior to the occupation. There's a requirement not to transfer a population in or out of the territory. Those kinds of humanitarian law norms apply in wartime independently from any human rights norm. Similarly, there are human rights norms that apply in wartime that are not comparable to any corresponding humanitarian norm. For example, in the in the Israeli barrier advisory opinion, the ICJ relied in part on the violation of Palestinian freedom of movement on the West Bank as a result of the incursion of the barrier. And that freedom of movement right arises under the civil and political covenant without a corresponding humanitarian law right. So there was a freestanding human rights norm that was applied by the ICJ in that instance. Probably, however, the most common situation is where there are norms from both bodies of law that apply, and then the question is, how do you reconcile the two? There is both a general rule and an exception. The general rule is that the human rights norm applies, but the more specific humanitarian law norm is used to interpret the general human rights norm as lex specialis. So, for example, in the nuclear weapons advisory opinion case, the ICJ pointed out that the right to life continues to apply under the ICPR in a war situation, but the interpretation of the right to life, and in particular in what situations may civilians lawfully be killed in wartime, is specified by humanitarian law. So that's the general rule, but there are exceptions, and the exceptions are where humanitarian law sometimes, either expressly or by implication, defers to human rights law. For example, one of the most important provisions of humanitarian law when it comes to fair trials is Article 75 of Protocol 1, which is the safety net provision that covers anybody detained and prosecuted during war, whether or not that person qualifies for POW status or for civilian status under the Geneva Convention. Article 75 sets forth certain basic fair trial rights for such persons, but then adds in paragraph 75.8 that anyone being prosecuted in such a situation is entitled to, quote, any other more favorable protection, end quote, provided by any other treaty. And any other treaty would of course include the ICPR or other human rights treaties, as the ICRC commentary recognizes. Sometimes the incorporation of human rights into humanitarian law is by implication. For example, Common Article 3, another of the most important articles in all of humanitarian law, requires that all persons detained in wartime be given the judicial guarantees recognized as indispensable by civilized people. Well, nowadays, I think it's very difficult to argue that those indispensable judicial guarantees do not include the entirety of Article 14 of the Civil and Political Covenant. Now let me turn to the relationship between criminal law, international criminal law, and humanitarian law. There are, of course, only some humanitarian law norms which are also criminal law norms. Not all violations of humanitarian law are ipso facto war crimes. There is a good but not a complete listing of those violations which amount to war crimes in Article 8 of the ICC statute. Passing on to the relationship between international criminal law and international human rights law. International criminal law enforces human rights law, but enforces only some of its norms, for example, the norm against torture. And for some human rights, international criminal law steps in only when there is a widespread or systematic pattern of violations so that the human rights violations amount to crimes against humanity. Human rights law, on the other hand, supports international criminal law in at least three ways. First, it provides, as Bob outlined in his introductory remarks, a legal basis for the duty to prosecute. International criminal law, in many instances, gives you the tools to prosecute, but it is the general obligation of states under human rights treaties to ensure respect and to guarantee human rights that has been interpreted as an important basis for the duty to actually use the tool that criminal law provides. Secondly, the fair trial norms from human rights law are incorporated into the statutes of the tribunals, as we heard from Judge Wald. And thirdly, and this hasn't been mentioned yet, human rights law is now and must now be used to interpret substantive criminal law norms. Article 21.3 of the ICC statute provides, quote, the application and interpretation of law pursuant to this article must be consistent with internationally recognized human rights, end quote. In sum, these three bodies of law, human rights, humanitarian, and criminal law, despite their differing historical origins, are no longer autonomous, separate bodies of law, but are expressly and by implication intertwined in many ways. The lesson for students and practitioners is that we must study all three bodies of law. The lesson for presidents and secretaries of defense and military commanders is that they must respect all three. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Doug. Our next speaker is Brian Tittimore, who is a senior staff attorney at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and I will mention that he is the primary author of the Commission's landmark study on terrorism and human rights, and Brian is a former director of the War Crimes Research Office.
Thank you, Professor Goldman, and I'd like to begin by thanking the Washington College of Law and the War Crimes Research Office for asking me to speak today. As Doug Cassell had noted, this is a really special occasion because it's the 10th anniversary of the War Crimes Research Office. And in my previous position as a senior research associate with the office, I had the privilege of working with dedicated and talented people like Professor Diane Ortlicker, Kelly Askin, Rokas Pronk, and other people who really enriched my experience when I first became involved with international human rights and humanitarian law. I think my presentation, I hope, will dovetail nicely with Doug's, because what I want to speak about are some of the issues that arise in applying international human rights and humanitarian law in the context of international terrorism. And this is obviously an issue that's been on the front burners for the last 4 or 5 years, certainly since September 11th. And I think that a closer analysis illustrates that it isn't always easy to be able to intertwine the rights that are protected under, in particular, international human rights and international humanitarian law. Traditionally, the issue of terrorism has been treated through a criminal law enforcement paradigm. So we've seen this reflected both in the national domestic laws, where national laws criminalize acts of terrorism in various respects and subject those crimes to prosecution before national courts. This paradigm is also reflected in multilateral treaties that address the issue of different forms of terrorism, like the International Convention Against the Taking of Hostages and the Convention on the Prevention of and Punishment of Crimes Against Internationally Protected Persons. You know, these treaties generally include, among other provisions, articles that define particular acts of terrorism as criminal offenses for the purposes of the treaties, that oblige states' parties to make the offenses punishable by appropriate penalties under domestic law, and require states' parties to establish their jurisdiction over offenses and suspected offenders in particular cases and to prosecute and extradite alleged offenders. Increasingly, anti-terrorism treaties such as the 2002 Inter-American Convention Against Terrorism are explicitly requiring that measures carried out by states' parties must comply and take place with full respect for the rule of law, human rights, and fundamental freedoms. Similarly, international human rights law has traditionally evaluated anti-terrorism initiatives within the context of domestic law enforcement initiatives against terrorism. And one can look at some of the case law of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, among other international supervisory bodies, to see that they've exercised their supervisory jurisdiction in order to evaluate anti-terrorism initiatives within the domestic legal systems of states. And through this process, there have been a number of key issues that these bodies have had to address. These include, for example, efforts to define the crime of terrorism and compliance with the principle of legality, the use of military or faceless courts to try terrorist crimes and terrorist offenders, and the use of methods of interrogation that might be considered to constitute torture or other cruel, inhuman, or degrading punishment. And these and other issues remain alive as states continue their efforts to combat terrorism within their jurisdictions. However, new and different challenges have arisen with the introduction of international humanitarian law as an additional source of law potentially applicable to terrorist violence and states' responses to that violence. And this has occurred principally since September 11th. This isn't to say that the use of humanitarian law
in relation to circumstances that might give rise to or involve terrorist violence is unprecedented. And again, making reference to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, it has addressed the application of anti-terrorist initiatives in the context of internal armed conflicts, for example, in Colombia, where internal armed groups might use terrorist tactics in their hostilities and where states may use exceptional anti-terrorist initiatives in responding to that type of violence. Under these instances, however, the standards of treatment under international humanitarian law applicable to the victims of internal armed conflicts do not, for the most part, vary considerably from non-derogable human rights norms, with some limited exceptions pertaining primarily to the right to life, as Doug had mentioned. What September 11th and the aftermath have brought to the forefront is the treatment of terrorist violence in a context where the rules governing international armed conflict might be engaged. That is, where terrorist violence triggers or occurs in the context of an armed conflict that is international in nature. And the significance of this development is linked to the fact that the legal regime applicable to international armed conflicts, in contrast to the rules governing internal armed conflict, is comprised of a discrete, complex, and detailed rules and principles that encompasses and reflects core principles beyond considerations of humanity, including the principle of military necessity, and is among the oldest bodies of international law. Partly as a consequence, international humanitarian law may in some respects be difficult to reconcile with modern manifestations of terrorism, as well as with current human rights norms. And in particular, the possible intersection between terrorism and international humanitarian law has given rise to some crucial threshold issues. These include, for example, whether an international terrorist group or organization, with or without the collaboration or support of a state or government, can be considered a party to an international armed conflict. And if so, under what circumstances, and how is the existence and duration of the conflict defined? Similarly, there are questions about whether members of terrorist groups or organizations can claim entitlement to prisoner of war status, and the combatant's privilege, which would preclude their prosecution for hostile acts that otherwise comply with the laws or customs of war. Alternatively, can these individuals be considered civilians, despite the fact that they engage in hostilities? So these are threshold issues, and among these issues is also defining the relationship between conventional and customary international human rights law and how this applies to these interpretations of humanitarian law. And this has been an issue of focus in recent court decisions in the international legal community, and I'd like to discuss it principally in the context of one issue where difficulties have arisen, and this is in the issue of apprehension and detention of terrorist suspects. Under international human rights law, the rules governing deprivations of liberty are viewed as among the most fundamental, owing to the fact that these protections, and if these protections are not afforded, frequently lead to other serious human rights violations, such as forced disappearances and torture. In this regard, international and regional human rights treaties generally require that any deprivation of liberty be based upon grounds and procedures established by law, the detainees be informed of the reasons for the detention and promptly notified of the charges against them, and that they be provided with access to legal counsel. In addition, prompt and effective oversight of detention by a judge or other officer authorized by law to exercise judicial power must be ensured to verify the legality of the detention and to protect other fundamental rights of the detainee. And the detainee has the right to be tried within a reasonable time or released without prejudice to the continuation of the proceedings. Further, bodies like the UN Human Rights Committee and the Inter-American Court of Human Rights have held that the right to take proceedings to court to enable it to decide without delay on the lawfulness of detention should not be and must not be diminished by a state's decision to derogate. So essentially, tools like the right to habeas corpus have been determined to be non-derogable. In contrast, one can see different rules under international humanitarian law that govern the detention of individuals who are protected under those provisions. In particular, Articles 21, 118, and 119 of the Third Geneva Convention permit the internment of prisoners of war until their repatriation at the cessation of active hostilities or the completion of any criminal proceedings or punishment for an indictable offense that may be pending against a prisoner of war. There is no explicit requirement that measures be available to challenge his internment before a court or otherwise. At most, Article 5 of the Third Geneva Convention provides that in the event that any doubt arises to whether persons qualify as a prisoner of war, such persons shall enjoy the protection of the present convention until such time as their status has been determined by a competent tribunal. In contrast, articles of the Fourth Geneva Convention applicable to enemy aliens in the territory of a party or protected persons in occupied territories can be interned only where the security of the detaining or occupying power makes it absolutely necessary. And these provisions also mandate that any such person shall have the right to have such action reconsidered or appealed within the least possible delay, and if it is continued, subject to periodic review. Now, there is some debate on this issue about status under the Third and the Fourth Geneva Convention concerning the status of what are referred to as unprivileged or unlawful combatants. And the debate essentially revolves around whether unprivileged or unlawful combatants should be considered to fall under the definition of protected persons in the Third and Fourth Geneva Conventions, or whether, at least in some circumstances, these individuals constitute classes of persons who do not benefit from more favorable treatment under either the 1949 conventions or the additional protocols, and where the provisions of Article 75, which Doug had referred to, would be considered to cover their situation. And this debate has come up principally in the context of individuals who have been captured who aren't considered to qualify for prisoner of war status. And this leads to the question of how to reconcile these various rules when a terrorist suspect is apprehended in the course of what is accepted or presumed to constitute an international armed conflict. Now, as Doug had mentioned, the International Court of Justice suggested that there are three different possibilities in defining the interrelationship between human rights and humanitarian law. Either one applies to the exclusion of the other, both apply at the same time. In the context of deprivations of liberty, international human rights bodies appear to have adopted what appears to be a variation on these possibilities. One example is the approach that the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights took in the 2002 report on terrorism and human rights, where the commission held that by reason of the particular and more specific legal principles of humanitarian law applicable under the Geneva Conventions, that the detention of combatants in internal armed conflict should not be considered to provide any entitlement on the part of a detained combatant to be informed of the reasons for their detention, to challenge the legality of their detention, or in the absence of disciplinary or criminal proceedings, the right to access to counsel. At the same time, the Commission recognized that there may be circumstances in which the continued existence of active hostilities becomes uncertain, or where a belligerent occupation continues over a prolonged period of time, and that there may be a concern about whether the mechanisms under international humanitarian law are sufficient to protect fundamental human rights. And in these circumstances, the Commission stated that where detainees find themselves in these uncertain or protracted situations of armed conflict or occupation, the supervisory mechanisms as well as judicial guarantees under international human rights law and domestic law, including habeas corpus, may necessarily supersede international human rights law whether it's necessary to safeguard fundamental rights. A similar approach was suggested by the UN independent expert on the protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms while countering terrorism, Professor Robert Goldman, in his February 2005 report to the UN Human Rights Commission, where he stated that during international armed conflicts and occupations, certain procedural protections otherwise afforded to individuals detained, certain categories of persons such as prisoners of war may be detained without the procedural protections otherwise afforded to individuals detained in peacetime. However, given the concurrent application of international human rights and humanitarian law during armed conflicts, human rights bodies and or domestic courts might have to protect the basic rights of wartime detainees where mechanisms under international humanitarian law for determining their legal status or supervising their treatment are not observed or prove ineffective. So it appears that the Inter-American Commission and also the UN independent expert have taken a somewhat graduated view that you can have situations where the more specific rules under international humanitarian law apply, but that depending on how successful those provisions prove, you may have to then resort to international human rights law in order to fill in any gaps that appear. I would mention that any approach that a state might take to this issue may depend to a significant extent on whether there is an intention to prosecute individuals for their terrorist activities, if those prosecutions are to comply with minimum standards of fair trial under both human rights and humanitarian law. And in particular, while states might be justified in detaining terrorist suspects who might be considered combatants in international armed conflict, absent the usual protections available in peacetime, the denial of certain protections, such as being brought promptly before a court, the failure to provide access to counsel, conducting interrogations in the absence of counsel, and failing to try individuals in a reasonable time, may jeopardize any subsequent effort in order to achieve accountability for terrorism-related crimes through criminal prosecutions. I'd like to finish just by noting that in a couple of recent decisions of both the U.S. Supreme Court and House of Lords in the United Kingdom, it appears that the courts have taken a similarly cautious approach to the availability of courts to supervise detention, even when there's a presumption that detention has taken place in the context of an armed conflict. In the June 2004 decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of Rasul versus Bush, for example, a majority of the court held that U.S. courts had jurisdiction to hear claims for habeas corpus in relation to prisoners at Guantanamo Bay by virtue of the fact that they were being held under the authority and control of the state. And the court emphasized the longstanding and fundamental role played by writs of habeas corpus in guaranteeing, in guarding against executive imprisonment in peacetime as well as in times of war. It's interesting that Mr. Justice Kennedy, who joined in the majority, articulated a graduated approach to the availability of extended review of detention, similar to what had been articulated by the commission and the independent expert. In particular, in contrasting the detainees in Guantanamo Bay with who were being held indefinitely and without the benefit of legal proceedings to determine their status, with the situation of prisoners who have already been tried and convicted by a military commission, Mr. Justice Kennedy observed that in indefinite detention without trial or other proceeding, it presents an altogether different considerations. It allows friends and foes alike to remain in detention. It suggests a weaker case of a military necessity and much greater alignment with the traditional function of habeas corpus. Perhaps where detainees are taken from a zone of hostilities, detention without proceedings or trial would be justified by military necessity for a matter of weeks. But as the period of detention stretches from months to years, the case for continued detention to meet military exigencies becomes weaker. So it appears that the domestic courts are also taking a somewhat cautious and graduated approach to the way that international humanitarian law and international human rights law apply, and that the issue of deprivation of liberty has really provided sort of a key for the courts to articulate their views on this point. In closing, I would suggest that it would be wise for us to keep in mind our experiences in facing threats to national security and international peace and security in the past when interpreting and applying human rights and humanitarian law in the face of modern terrorist threats. In the Belmarsh prison case, the decision of the House of Lords of December of 2004, Lord Hoffman observed in his opinion that the exceptional power to derogate from those rights protected under the Constitution are also reflected in British constitutional history. There have been times of great national emergency in which habeas corpus has been suspended and powers to detain on suspicion conferred on the government. It happened during the Napoleonic War and during the both world wars in the 20th century. These powers were conferred with great misgiving and in the sober light of retrospect after the emergency had passed were often found to have been cruelly and unnecessarily exercised. But let us hope that we will not look back on today's struggle against terrorism and violence with similar regrets. Thank you very much.
We do have a little bit of time. So if there are questions, there are two microphones here, and anyone who would like to ask a question, please approach the mic, and if you'd identify yourself and address yourself to a specific panelist or...
Good morning. My name is Ethan Berger. I teach adjunct here as well as the University of Baltimore. I have a question essentially for Professor Castle. It's always bothered me that human rights law operates in the context as if history did not exist. For example, if you look at Latvia, you know, there's a big concern about citizenship in Latvia and how the Latvians are violating ethnic Russians, you know, rights under the OSCE or CSCE agreements. You look at the Germans who were expelled from Sudetenland after World War II. You look at the movement of the borders of Poland. You look at the Hungarians who are in Romania. And so you have a conflict between human rights law and the basic principles of international law in terms of inviolability of borders and the whole Westphalian system. So how do you reconcile history with human rights law? If you believe, as I do, that you need to take account of history and take account of the concept of group rights.
Well, human rights law, of course, emerges from history. If we had not had the Holocaust, we would not have the Genocide Convention. We might not have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So human rights law is not oblivious to history. On the other hand, human rights law is not written by a committee of historians. It's written by diplomats like Valerie used to be representing their governments. And so human rights law ends up, conventional positive human rights law, ends up being a compromise between what might be the abstract lessons of history or morality on the one hand and the what states are willing to agree to on the other hand, and that's not a constant fixed variable. That depends on public opinion and pressures and so forth. So it's not at all surprising that if you look at any body of law, and certainly human rights law, from the point of view of a pure criterion such as the lessons of history or morality, you're going to find that it is imperfect. But the second point to be made is that it's not fixed in time. It's a dialectical process. So, for example, with respect to the rights of non-citizens, if you haven't yet had a chance to take a look at Advisory Opinion 18 of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights on the rights of undocumented migrant workers, the Inter-American Court, in that opinion, took the basic principle of equality and said that it requires equal protection of labor rights for undocumented migrant workers. And in the United States, as you know, as you well know, those people are referred to as, quote, illegal aliens. So there's opportunity for movement, but that movement depends on people like those in this room and institutions like American University to push it forward.
Right there.
Hello, my name is Catherine Southwick. I'm in private practice in Washington and recently returned from an independent research trip to northern Uganda because I was interested in developments in the peace process and the ICC investigation there. One of the things that has been controversial about the northern Uganda case is its potential interference with an ongoing peace process. And part of the controversy relates to whether or not if the ICC applies pressure in a certain way, it could actually lead to greater insecurity of vulnerable communities and communities that have been victims for nearly 20 years. So what I'm wondering is when Professor Castle was talking about the relationship between human rights law and international criminal law, you spoke about ways in which they mutually reinforce each other, but I think here we may have an instance where human rights law may be in conflict with international criminal law. And in the sense of if carrying out a particular mandate of international criminal law conflicts with basic principles of assuring or taking all possible measures to assure personal security, the right to life, and so forth, or the right to food or the right to adequate humanitarian assistance, what principles might you suggest to the prosecutor or to the ICC or to anyone out here in helping to resolve that tension?
Very quickly, I don't think there's any necessary inconsistency in that situation between human rights and criminal law. But now, if you will permit me to do the American football equivalent of a punt, We have a panel on that this afternoon. I see Eric Stover sitting in the room, and I know others are on the panel, and I think that question might be better directed to them.
My name is Beth Lyons. I'm a defense attorney. I work for Legal Aid. I also represent a client at the ICTR, and I'm an alternate rep to the UN for International Association of Democratic Lawyers. The rights of defendants, the presumption of innocence, and particularly the rights to fair trial, are an integral part of international human rights law, ICCPR, UNDHR, and regional equivalents. And I want to make an observation and ask for any comment from any panelist on this issue. The question is, what role for the defense? I mean, I think today there's an excellent program here, excellent speakers. I'm very, very interested in it. But it seems to me that, unfortunately, one glaring omission is there is neither a representative nor a panel addressing the vital issues of the rights of the defendant and of defense counsel. And I don't think it's possible to evaluate prior tribunals, including from 45 on, the ones we have now, and look into the future without addressing this issue. So I would characterize it as an omission, but the real question is where does defense counsel fit in? Where do the fundamental rights of the accused or defendants fit into this very, very important discussion we're having today?
Let me take an initial crack at that. I agree with you that the role of defense counsel is absolutely paramount in protecting the rights of defendants in these international and in the national tribunals, not only their rights, and there are some under international humanitarian law, but their rights under human rights law when the two coalesce. I think that is reflected, as you well know, in most of the charters we're familiar with, certainly in the ICTY and the ICTR charters, but even more so in the rules that the courts have adopted pursuant that. Certainly, the ICC has taken it one step further. I mean, the ICC has had a lot of, although they're just getting started and haven't actually started the trial process yet, they've had numerous conferences on the role of defense. They're setting up an office of defense, and they have taken it, I think, they have ethical codes for defense lawyers. They've taken it one step further. I didn't have a chance to get into as much detail because of time problems, but it's also a terribly important role where the national government attempts to set up a war crimes tribunal, too, as to whether or not what the rights of the defense counsel, for instance, in the Cambodian and Iraqi situations, the question has arisen when the counsel, either the lead counsel or all the counsel, have to be of the same nationality, Iraqi or Cambodian, although I think in both cases you can have international lawyers as assistants, but what those rights are and whether those international lawyers can fully fulfill those rights is important. I don't know, I didn't help to set up the conference, but I think nobody I know who's been involved in these, either the ad hoc tribunals or the national tribunals, isn't acutely aware that that's where, just as in American justice, you're going to look right away to see about the rights of the defense counsel. Ironically, and I'll quit here, one of the key questions that's come up, probably resulting from the Milosevic trial and perhaps in anticipation of the Saddam Hussein trial, is this right, which up to now has been embodied in all of the charters of a defendant to represent himself, not to have counsel. And that's become a real question, whether or not, if you take away that worrying about the defendant, the most notorious defendants using it as a bully pulpit, are you taking away some kind of basic human rights thing. But I agree with you, and I'm sure in conference number two, even more attention will be given to that aspect.
Well, I think in light of the time, we're going to have to conclude this panel. We're going to do what our civilized neighbors to the north call a health break until 11:30.
and we will resume properly. Thank you very much to the panel.
Okay, you're